This is Linda Ravenswood, host of Poets Cafe. Tune in Wednesdays at 2 p.m. for the best in poetry from Los Angeles and beyond, right here at KPFK, your home for art, humanities, music, political discourse, and, as always, poetry. That's Poets Cafe, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on listener-supported KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. Pacifica Radio for Southern California and beyond.
Welcome to Gray Zone Radio. I'm your host and the editor of thegrayzone.com, Max Blumenthal. As President Joe Biden wrapped up a public relations stunt visit in Kiev, where he reassured Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky of his support, residents of the Rust Belt town of East Palestine, Ohio, were left to determine whether they would be able to still live in their town after the freight line company Norfolk Southern detonated one of its trains, which had derailed in the center of town. The supposedly controlled explosion sent tons of vinyl chloride pouring out into the town's waterways, killing thousands of animals, and polluting East Palestine's air with a foul smell. Residents reported their lungs stinging after the explosion. While Biden was too busy tending to Zelensky to visit Ohio, journalist Jeremy Lofredo took a series of trips to East Palestine to report on the chemical disaster and its impact on the town's residents, exclusively for the Gray Zone. You'll now hear Jeremy's exclusive report, which gives voice to the town's local residents and exposes the role of private police and corporate front groups in East Palestine, playing the role of environmental monitors and local security. Take a listen.
I've driven through Ohio a few times while on road trips heading west from New York. I didn't ever think I would return to Ohio in order to report on an environmental disaster. On February 3rd, a freight train carrying millions of pounds of toxic chemicals derailed in the middle of East Palestine, a remote village of 4,000 people, 50 miles west of Pittsburgh. What I found in East Palestine, now 2 weeks later, was a tiny village being consumed by fear, private police, confusion, sickness, and entirely captured and corrupt environmental protection groups. After the derailment, toxic chemicals leaked from the train cars and remained on and around the tracks for 2 days. The tracks were cleared when Norfolk Southern, the corporation that owns the railroad, decided to line the poison-filled train cars with explosives and burn the chemicals instead of safely and carefully draining them. They called this a, quote, controlled ventilation. The explosion caused a toxic mushroom cloud to form over the entire town, and dust and particulates from the burnt chemicals fell down to the ground and coated the town like snow. East Palestine is a quaint town, and while driving around the roads that weren't blocked off by train authorities, I saw the town theater, the town car wash, the liquor store, the high school, and separating the town right down the middle is the now infamous railroad. Other than the dust, the local news crews, and the closed shops and stores, it seemed like a regular small town in rural America. But after going to the creek, it was obvious that something was very irregular about the town, even though East Palestine was being told everything was safe. The creek was littered with death. Nothing was alive. Dead earthworms, dead fish, dead frogs, and even more dead fish. I found East Palestinians to be extraordinarily kind, but they were not happy. They were scared, and they were skeptical of everything they were being told by the same authorities that allowed for this disaster to happen. Employees at a hardware store no more than 100 yards from Ground Zero explained to me that they didn't believe Norfolk Southern from the get-go.
Do you trust the company when they come out and say, everything's safe, we tested everything?
No, I don't. I know what I felt in my lungs. I've got healthy lungs. Well, I did have. Don't know what shape they're in now. But how can you trust somebody who's telling you, well, it's only going out a mile, when you live 3.3 miles away, and I walk outside the morning of, and my lungs burnt. They felt like they were on fire by the time I walked out and walked back in. So, no, I don't trust anything they say.
I don't think there's any content feelings around here. My experience has been that people are still pretty much up in the air and uninformed and feel like they're being manipulated.
Do you think that the company should be trusted when they say everything's safe, everything's good to go?
No, I don't trust them. I mean, everybody has to make their own decision on that one. But I don't trust them.
Why not?
Big business.
You hear people suing McDonald's because they spilled their own cup of coffee on themselves and getting millions. We're dealing with toxic chemicals in our air where our kids play.
Common sense says you're going to burn poisonous material out in up into the air. If you and I did that, we'd be in jail, right? But they can come in and burn millions of gallons or whatever it was. Yeah. They have a set, different set of rules, I guess.
At the center of the disaster is the environmental toxic and safety testing that's going on. The testing is being done by none other than Norfolk Southern. The town's welcome sign in the middle of town is being used to direct residents, not to independent experts, but the experts at Norfolk Southern.
Who's doing the testing, you know, in the houses?
I do believe it's Norfolk Southern.
Do you think that they're the best people to carry out those tests?
No.
Why?
No, because they can rig those machines to say whatever they want them to say to give everybody a false sense of security. We don't know. We don't know what's in the air. We don't know what's in our homes. I know some of the people are getting someone privately to come into their homes, which probably is probably a much better idea.
The people that caused the accident are responsible for it and going to take a financial hit and a PR hit are the ones that are funding and managing all of the analysis and all the treatment. No, that's not credible for most people.
Assisting Norfolk Southern with toxic testing is their privately held contractor, the Center for Toxicology and Environmental Health, or CTEH. According to critics, CTEH has a history of minimizing the effects of environmental disasters to satisfy their corporate clients. CTEH was at the center of several environmental disasters, including the BP oil spill. According to a toxicologist that spoke to the New York Times, CTEH's environmental studies and toxicology tests are designed to meet the goals of its clients. Quote, they're paid to say, everything's okay. The Norfolk Southern YouTube account recently posted a bizarre, seemingly promotional video for CTEH.
Sarah Burnett is a toxicologist with CTEH, an environmental consulting firm. She's one of dozens of scientists in East Palestine helping answer those questions about air quality.
So what do you say to them? What is that answer?
I say to them that we have detected no vinyl chloride or other constituents related to this incident in the air, and that all of our air monitoring and sampling data collectively do not indicate any short or long-term risks to them, their children, or their families.
Also taking the lead in preparing testing and analysis for the EPA is another private contractor with an arguably even more controversial history. Their name is Tetra Tech. The news that Tetra Tech has been hired by the EPA to handle this environmental disaster does not exist. But page 3 of the EPA's air safety results expose this unsavory reality. Tetra Tech is owned by the same main shareholders as Norfolk Southern, BlackRock, and Vanguard. Tetra Tech is being sued by the Department of Justice for providing entirely fraudulent soil samples to the EPA in order to protect their client, the U.S. Navy. This willing attempt for the supposed environmental group to sweep a toxic radiological disaster under the rug has been called, quote, the biggest case of eco-fraud in U.S. history. Getting around this town is very difficult. There are many roadblocks, but the public roads are not being patrolled and the roadblocks are not being enforced by local police, instead by out-of-staters. Private police, Norfolk Southern Police. The fact that a $1 billion company's armed private police force is patrolling the streets of a tiny village where the company just committed an act of environmental terrorism is troubling, but true. Connor Spielmaker, the senior communications manager for Norfolk Southern, explained to me over the phone that Norfolk Southern PD is in fact the corporation's private police force, but they're only in town to, quote, assist local PD and make sure everyone stays safe. But people in the town believe it's these private police that are calling the shots. Their local officials have told them this much.
I called like Ohio Department of Transportation, State Highway Patrol, our local police force, and they're all pointing the finger at Norfolk police department in charge of these roadblocks and the road closures and everything? Like, why are they above local and state and enforcement?
What is Norfolk?
So if they're both active,
I would like to know too. Sounds like Pinkertons to me, private police.
I don't think it's right. I don't think it's right. They don't live here. They don't know what this town needs and what it don't need. I think our own local cops and our state police in Ohio should be taken over. They should take over what's going on instead of letting them run shot over everything. I believe they would have a better interest in the people and what's going on here.
A guy named Brandon stopped in. I asked him for a card, but they don't have cards. Yeah, the Dodge Durango driving around. It's an unmarked Dodge Durango, souped up with red and blue lights, out of state plates. And I talked to the police chief here in East Palestine. His last name's Brown. And he told me that they're in charge and they're out front of my building. They're out front of the building right now. And they want to talk to me because I have concerns.
The workers at the roadblock told me that they answer to the Norfolk Southern Police Department. The power dynamic is evident here in this video, as local public police wait at the roadblock set up by the private police and manned by out-of-towners. According to Norfolk Southern's Facebook, the Norfolk Southern Police Department is responsible for crime prevention and criminal investigations involving Norfolk Southern corporate interests. The department supports 49 field offices, 5 special investigation units, 3 special operations response teams, 12 canine units, a police communication center, and a headquarters in Atlanta. After the derailment and subsequent controlled ventilation, information and evacuation orders were contradictory and scarce. This letter was placed on residents' front doors, assuring East Palestinians that their children were safe, their pets were safe, and they likened the smoke to a wood fire. The letter is missing any government or company affiliation. The letter is filled with bold, incorrect, and scientifically unsubstantiated claims. When I asked Connor Spielmaker, the senior communications manager for Norfolk Southern, if this dubious letter was the work of the company, he candidly and perhaps accidentally explained, yes, it looks familiar.
You've been listening to journalist Jeremy Lafredo's exclusive report from East Palestine, Ohio. You can see the full video of it at the Gray Zone's YouTube channel. We'll now pick up where we left off with Jeremy's report.
The gas station directly across the street from Brenda's place of work was evacuated during the incident. But even though she was closer to the tracks, she was never given the evacuation order or instruction, possibly poisoning her and her coworkers.
Well, they evacuated those guys. They packed up and left. And then they walked across the street and I said, are you coming to evacuate me? And he said, no. And those guys were gone and we were here. We were here for 2 days after they were gone.
You're actually closer to the railroads, right?
To the tracks, yeah.
I think it's the money. That's basically what it boils down to. They'll pay one guy, but the guy across the street, they won't pay him because he's 1.1 miles from it. You know, and that's ridiculous. This water has been tested all the way down to Weirton, West Virginia, and they found traces of it. So if it's going that far in the waterway, where else is it going?
You know, their main concern was to get the railroad, the rail line open so they could move freight. That's all they cared about. When the guy from Norfolk Southern came on right after it happened to talk about, you know, their plans, the first thought that came out of his mouth was, you know, they're going to get this all cleaned and opened up and the tracks down and get the trains running. There was no talk about, well, you know, we're going to find out what people need. And, you know, people were thrown out of their houses. I mean, they couldn't stay there. But I haven't seen anybody from Norfolk Southern come in and say, hey, you know, how's this affected you financially? Here's a check. Mm-hmm. You know, put your money where your mouth is. Don't spout all this baloney and, you know, feel good stuff, and nothing really happens. People are still stuck in the motels and in their relative's house, and you know, it's just total inconvenience and not getting much help.
All of the East Palestinians that I spoke to have stories of wildlife and neighbors suffering from health effects or sickness that Norfolk Southern does not acknowledge. Brenda, an employee at a local gas station 20 feet from the railroad, explained to me that a family doctor told her sister-in-law not to return home, even though they were being told it was entirely safe by Norfolk Southern.
I mean, my sister-in-law lives two blocks over and she can't even go home. Her doctor said for her not to go home. She's on oxygen. That's the doctor telling her, no, it's not a good idea for you to go home. It makes me feel frightened. I know the first day I came through, the sky was glowing after this all happened. So it's like, it's a sad situation. And I hate seeing these people in this town hurt because these are the nicest people. They're the nicest people you'd ever want to know. And I don't think they're being told the truth.
The guy who works for me, Tim, you met him, right? And he told me today that I think it's his wife's little dog was outside, and then he went home and the little dog was just in there shaking like a convulsion. And he's not in the zone. Mm-hmm. He's north. He's about 3 miles from here. So that kind of got my attention. You know, because we have a little dog, and we've got the goats and all that, and the chickens are still there, and they laid for about a week, and then they kind of slowed down. And today I went in, and there was no eggs. So one of our customers came in, and they're south in Negley. I couldn't believe this. He said it was a skunk, and he said it was sitting in the driveway or the parking lot, and it was just convulsing. I saw the video. And it just went on for a few minutes. He said they finally just put it out of its misery. And they also saw a raccoon, similar situation. I didn't get the detail. But I said, well, you know, because they're right there in Negley, right close by the waterway. So I'm guessing maybe it got drank out of the stream. Who knows? I don't know what happened.
Nobody really believes what's going on. You go try to buy water around town, nobody wants to drink the water, even though they say it's safe.
At first, health effects on animals was considered conspiracy theory and rumor by authorities and the mainstream media. But that seems to be changing. According to the Washington Post, who in the very beginning of the toxic derailment dismissed the disaster as a, quote, right-wing cause, is now reporting on thousands of dead fish and wildlife, interviewing residents in East Palestine whose pets have debilitating conditions because of the explosion and fallout. Kayla Miller spoke to the Washington Post and explained that some of her chickens now suffer from seizures and some have stopped walking entirely. They believe Norfolk Southern is putting their reputation and bottom line in front of people's health. They are under the impression that the, quote, controlled burn did not have to happen, but instead it was just the fastest and cheapest way to get their freight back on the tracks.
I believe the controlled burn shouldn't have happened. I believe that it cost the railroad more to pump that liquid off and haul it away. It cost them more money and would have cost them more in time. It should have never released more of that chemical into the atmosphere and into the air we breathe. The railroad benefits from it because they're saving time and money. And I believe that's why they done the controlled burn. It gets them back on the rails faster. And it didn't help anybody around here. It had to benefit the railroad to do it that way. Because it's not going to benefit our wildlife, our domestic animals, the people that breathe the air, the water, the soil. It just made it worse.
While I was in East Palestine, there was the first ever town hall meeting organized by the town. It took place at the high school gymnasium.
Tonight there's supposed to be a meeting over by the school at 7 o'clock, and I'm pretty confident there's going to be quite a lot of people there upset.
Are you going to go?
I would like to, but it's syrup making season, and I love making the maple syrup, and we're going to make it just like we did last year, but we're going to send it out and see if somebody can test it and make sure it's good to consume.
After residents heard that a representative for Norfolk Southern would be there in person, thousands of people showed up. It looked like the entire town was in line. Soon before the start of the town hall, Norfolk Southern pulled out and decided not to come, citing the threat of possible violence. But according to the local police department, there was no threat.
I was not surprised when they bowed out. Well, that's not taking care of your responsibility. It's almost like they just didn't want to talk to people. They don't want somebody saying something that they shouldn't be saying. It's like the narrative is all very much controlled.
My house is in a very close proximity to Sulphur Run Creek. It's about 7 steps to my front door. When they came down to do my air testing, I was asking for more testing than just that. I wanted the water and soil tested. The creek runs with embankments on both sides. the creek swells when the water rises from a rainstorm, so I wanted testing. A gentleman came down from the railroad. He agreed that there was some concern, and he sent their senior toxicologist in to look at my house specifically. I got a phone call today from the railroad saying that my house is unsafe. They wouldn't recommend that I stay there. They're going to pay for all my moving expenses, first month's, last month's rent. I'm supposed to get an estimate back to them. It's not about money. If I would have been in that house with my three-year-old daughter in those toxic fumes, I don't know if I'd be standing here talking to you today. And if they were wrong about my house, how many other houses are they wrong about? How many of these other people are sleeping in there? When I just told the mayor about this, no one even informed the mayor that it wasn't safe for me to go home. So if it's not safe for me to go home, no one should be going home.
Like many other chemical disasters involving forever chemicals and carcinogens, the worst, in terms of the health effects, are probably and unfortunately yet to come. With private police roaming around and captured and corrupted environmental protection groups, the people in East Palestine are left to protect themselves.
So with all of this uncertainty and all this toxicity and unknown, how do we live here? Would it become a ghost town at some point? There's all these questions we ask. You know, here's my question. Is BlackRock going to come in and buy all this? We see how big, you know, people with lots of power and control work. We just feel like we're being used and pushed around. You know, they come in and they damage us severely, and then they just push you around and tell you what they're going to do.
That was journalist Jeremy Lafredo's exclusive report from East Palestine, Ohio. You can see the full video at the Gray Zone's YouTube channel. This week marked the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But as even NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has acknowledged, the war did not begin on February 24, 2022. It actually started in 2014, following a U.S.-backed coup that removed Ukraine's elected president, installed a nationalist regime, and began to wage war on the country's ethnic Russian population in the east with U.S. weapons and training. Over the past year, Americans have seen close to $100 billion of their tax dollars funnel to the arms industry and Ukrainian military to sponsor Kiev's war effort. Europeans, meanwhile, have suffered further erosion to their standard of living under the watch of the EU, as their governments have obeyed U.S. orders to blockade Russian energy, a policy that has amounted to boomerang sanctions on an entire continent. While investigative journalist Seymour Hirsch reports that the U.S. military destroyed the Nord Stream pipelines connecting Germany to a vital supply of Russian gas, the German government seems curiously disinterested in investigating the sabotage of its own vital infrastructure. An attack that amounts to the worst act of industrial and environmental sabotage in human history. Berlin has at the same time acceded to U.S. demands to send German Leopard battle tanks to Ukraine, setting the stage for the first confrontation between German and Russian armor since World War II. History is repeating itself in one of the darkest ways imaginable. And now it appears that a growing segment of the European public is getting fed up. On the week of the anniversary of the Ukraine proxy war, city centers from Berlin to Paris to Brussels to Barcelona to London filled up with anti-war protesters, infuriated by the escalation of the conflict and outraged by the lack of concern by their leaders for their own declining standard of living, a direct result of the war. This was the backdrop for Joe Biden's supposedly surprise visit to Kiev, where he reassured Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky of his stalwart support. But as I and my colleague Aaron Mate illustrate here, the entire event was a theatrical sham, down to the air raid sirens that blared as Biden first appeared with Zelensky. Take a listen. But let's talk about Biden's trip to Ukraine really quickly. I mean, this was, to me, a desperate PR stunt. And I'd like to know what you think is behind Biden's decision. Here he is with Zelensky. And if Basically, a siren. Incoming. They're bombing Kiev with pallets of cash stolen from U.S. taxpayers, apparently. And they're surrounded with camera people. The whole area of the city sealed off. There's no one there.
I mean, this is so funny. Right when Biden and Zelensky pop out of that building, church, whatever it is, an air siren goes off as if they're under some kind of threat. And unfortunately, though, their ruse, their photo op was blown up by none other than CNN, which pointed out the inconvenient fact that Kiev hasn't even had air sirens go off at all in the last recent days until the very moment when Biden and Zelensky walked out.
I've been here for the past 5 days. I have not heard any explosions. I have not heard any air sirens until about half an hour ago, right when President Biden was in the center of Kyiv, as Clarissa was just mentioning. I've been here for the past 5 days. I have not heard.
So how cynical is that? How cynical is that? You're in a war zone. This country is being invaded, and you go there and you use your visit to pretend as if you're in some kind of threat. Like you're sort of making fun of Ukrainians who actually are living in fear of being bombed by using the air siren as a photo op. And of course, to making it all the more ridiculous, this idea that Biden and Zelensky are being daring and, you know, using an air siren to dramatize the situation is the fact, which got acknowledged somewhere in U.S. media, but not nearly enough, that the U.S. told Russia ahead of time that Biden was visiting. So there are all these stories about a cloak and dagger, covert Biden mission, and all these cable news pundits like falling over themselves to praise him for daring to go into a combat zone. And we have some of those clips. We can play them.
Well, let's look at the propaganda first, how this was sold. We got the BBC. This whole report is basically, it might as well have been written by the White House. Biden in Ukraine, how the president's surprise visit was kept a secret. And, you know, despite widespread speculation among the press corps that Mr. Biden might be planning a trip to Ukraine while he's in Poland, the visit still took everyone completely by surprise, right? The sight of him appearing beside Vladimir Zelensky in the heart of Kyiv and under the sound of air raid sirens makes a louder statement than anything he can say in a speech in Poland. That's the BBC's own writing. It reads like his own press secretary wrote, well, hey, here is his... someone who works for his press secretary, White House Communications Director Kate Bedingfield. It was risky and should leave no doubt in anyone's mind that Joe Biden is a leader who takes commitment seriously. But in reality, I mean, the U.S. told Russia. And what was Russia going to do? Were they actually going to shoot Biden down?
No. Well, that's the other funny thing is Biden didn't even fly right into Ukraine. He flew first to Germany. Okay, stopped in Germany, then they flew over to Poland, and then they took a car from the Polish airport to the border, and then at the border they took a train. So this idea of this like daring flight into the war zone, which some people like Claire McCaskill spread, that Biden like flew in, you know, covertly, like trying to evade the Russians into the war zone. It's a complete fantasy. And what happened was,
Hillary spread a similar lie about entering. I think it was Bosnia.
Yeah.
And she flew that they had to do this spiraling emergency landing to the onto the tarmac. It was just completely made up, but this is an even more gross deception. Here's a AP correspondent on how Biden actually pulled off his secret visit.
It's not unusual for presidents to visit war zones, certainly where Americans are combatants, but the critical difference between those trips and going to Kyiv is that the U.S. isn't a belligerent in Kyiv, in Ukraine.
Oh,
it doesn't control the airspace. It doesn't have a very large troop presence. President Biden spent about 23 hours on the ground on Ukrainian soil. That included about 5 hours in Kyiv and time on the train there and back. So the logistics of pulling something like this off safely were incredibly complex. Part of what allowed the president to do this is the notification to Russia. So
the notification
they wouldn't want
to
trigger
Russia.
Any sort of miscalculation that can start off essentially nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia, the two nuclear armed powers, but also U.S. surveillance planes flying along the Polish border.
So, they notified Russia. Steely-eyed Biden.
You know, by the way, a funny point here for haters of Seymour Hersh. These OSINT people see if they can find Biden's plane flying into Germany. See if they can find a record of that. They can't because the transmitters were turned off. And so all these OSINT people, when they try to, like, you know, dismiss Hirsch's reporting, and they say, oh, look, we can't find that surveillance, like the flight that set off the sonic boom that set off the bombs. We can't find that in our OSINT maps. That means there was no flight. That means that Hirsch is wrong. Well, try to find the flight of Biden flying into Germany. It's not there because they turned off the transmitter because a newsflash for Bellingcat and other OSINT people. Intelligence people think of this kind of stuff and they don't want their activities to be able to be picked up in open source. So that's why they hide it. And a similar thing happened, I think, with the bombing of the Nord Stream 2. That's just something that they overlooked, among many other things.
Yeah. Well, they'll do better following Elon Musk's jet, I guess.
Yeah. But in terms of why Biden went to Kiev, I think, you know, obviously a main reason is just for U.S. domestic consumption and for all of his media stenographers to praise him as this daring hero who went into a combat zone to shore up support for the proxy war at home 1 year into the war, with no appetite at all in Washington for any kind of diplomacy. They want to keep it going. And also because I think Zelensky probably needs the support too, because inside the Ukrainian government, we're talking about one of the most corrupt governments in the world. There's all kinds of infighting. There are people fighting over the loot, like fighting over the bounty that they're getting from the international community, especially the U.S. And Zelensky might be facing some challenges from within on that. And Biden going to meet him personally, I think, is a show of support. Like it's an endorsement that, like, you know, him putting his arm around Zelensky is a sign that the Godfather still backs this capo inside Kiev. So I think that's also what this was about.
Yeah, he's a capo in more ways than one.
I mean,
being a Jew at the top of a regime that backs literal Nazis makes him a different kind of capo.
That's true.
Well, Biden's visit also was accompanied by a desperate attempt to sell Americans on his bravery and on the importance of doing this while the country was suffering. Here's this is Douglas Brinkley on Biden's Kiev photo op.
As our resident historian,
court historian,
presidential visit.
Like always, this guy or Michael Betchloss.
Oh yeah,
the blow dried hair historians. Like real historians look kind of crazy and like, you know, they're chain smokers and they're wearing like tattered tweed jackets. These guys, they always have crisp suits and their hair is perfectly blow dried. They look like wax museum sculptures.
It's to war zones. Presidents have visited Iraq and Afghanistan in recent years, but those were U.S. wars. This is a Ukrainian war.
By the way, that's Jim Sciutto, not to be confused with Prosciutto. And he is a former State Department employee. He actually dropped his job at CNN to go work in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing under Obama and was the assistant chief of staff. He was the chief of staff to Gary Locke, who was the U.S. ambassador there. That's a pretty strategically significant embassy. So you basically have a guy who's repping for the State Department in the CNN anchor chair. In case it wasn't obvious,
that should be in his chyron when CNN identifies him. It should say former State Department propagandist. You know what's also funny about Jim Sciutto is when Russia invaded, he gave this like dramatic monologue from Ukraine, because remember, like back then, every Western correspondent flooded to Ukraine, and he was among them. And he gave this dramatic monologue where he said, before Russia invaded, Ukraine was at peace. It wasn't at war with anyone. There's been going on. It's like, did you not know that there's been a civil war going on there for 8 years that the U.S. was majorly involved in as well? And that was a major reason why Russia invaded, because actually Ukraine was escalating its assaults on eastern Ukraine, where ethnic Russians are, and was threatening to basically wipe it out. Like, did you not know that? Or are you just forgetting it? I don't know what these people, whether they're lying or they just don't even know the basic facts of the issues they're reporting on.
I mean, he's one of the most aggressive propagandists. He gets unfettered access to the national security state. John Brennan, by the way, former CIA director, he's an MSNBC contributor, right?
Yeah.
He's referred to merely as a national security contributor. They never note that it speaks for Langley when he appears on MSNBC. Here's a,
or
let's continue.
No U.S. military presence on the ground.
Hagiography.
It's extremely significant. The United States has wedded more to the Ukraine than ever before. I go back to history and think of Roosevelt and Churchill when FDR had to sneak off in the dead of night, even had a body double at one point to first meet Winston Churchill off the coast of Newfoundland. And then, of course, you had all those World War II meetings between Churchill.
Also had to sneak off to meet his mistress.
Mentioning Churchill, because Zelensky has been called the Churchill of our generation, and Biden going there today, I think it's going to be a moment for the history books. It's like when John F. Kennedy
went, he's the Churchill in that he uses poison gas on his enemies.
Went to Berlin in 1961 and gave a speech at the height of the Cold War. Ukraine is the new Berlin. It's the rally point for NATO and the Western allies. And I think Biden did something really heroic.
Well, there you have it. It was heroic. I don't know what normal people agree with that, but there we could go through so many clips of media praise, mainly on CNN.
It's just a spectacle.
Goes on and on. This is Claire McCaskill, who's the former right-wing Democratic governor of Missouri, and she's like, you know, the voice of the, she's the true voice of the of MSNBC now, the right wing of the Democratic Party.
This one's Nicole really funny. Wallace,
former George W. Bush flack. They always have like the true embodiment of the establishment when they bring four people on MSNBC.
I'm not sure that it was all pre-planned, but it has certainly all been well executed. His back and forth with the nuttiest of the nutty Republicans at the State of the Union, pulling off this trip and these images of defenders of democracy.
She always sounds kind of drunk.
Democracy from two very different generations walking shoulder to shoulder in Kyiv. What do you make of this?
Well, it's very important because in the back of everyone's mind, kitchen, there's always a contrast. There's always a comparison. And this kind of dovetails with what you talked about earlier, that when the president runs for re-election, it is not a referendum on him. It is a choice. And if you compare and contrast Donald Trump was afraid to go to Afghanistan.
Donald Trump was afraid to stay upstairs during the Black Lives Matter protests.
I mean, very little courage. And, you know, having flown into war zones a number of times, both Iraq and Afghanistan, as a member of the Senate, was there moments that it was weird? Yes, but there was always a sense that you're surrounded by the United States military. You're enveloped by the United States military. Mm. When that Air Force...
Kind of like the people of Afghanistan or the people in Ukraine. They're enveloped by the U.S. military. Isn't that reassuring?
One, flew over the border into Ukraine. Everybody knows it was just that airplane.
Sorry, I said she was governor. She was senator.
From the United States in that airspace. Mm. And that took courage.
Pause it there.
And that courage is a very important.
Yeah.
That's a lot. She doesn't realize this, but the plane did not fly into Ukraine.
Yeah.
It flew into Germany. Then he flew again to Poland, and then Poland took a car to the Polish border with Ukraine, and then took a train. So she's making up this idea that he flew in on this risky flight into this Ukraine war zone.
It's completely made up. I just want to point out something else here, which is interesting about MSNBC. You see the four people you have. This is like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. You have the Democratic Party centrist hack. Then you have the media guy to her left. I think that's like John Heilman, who's complete centrist regime lackey. Then you have the spook, who represents the deep state. I think that's Jeremy Bash, who is a former spokesperson for the CIA and the Pentagon.
You know, Max, I don't think that's Jeremy Bash.
That's not Jeremy Bash?
I don't think that is, no. It looks like him. I think that guy just might be a correspondent.
Okay, that's just the guy. Yeah, that's a correspondent. All right, my bad. Well, they often have the spook, and then they have Nicole Wallace, who's, you know, the Bush Republican.
Yeah.
So this is really the regime right there.
Yeah.
And that's that regime includes Pompeo,
yeah,
and Nikki Haley. So that's what they're lining up against Trump.
Yeah.
Anyway, remarkable stuff. I mean, they just are straight up lying about Biden's trip. The air raid siren was fake. The surprise was fake. The landing in Kyiv was fake. The whole thing was a gigantic stunt. And, you know, if he had just taken a car to East Palestine, Ohio, I think he'd be slightly more well-liked by Americans, but that's not who he's catering to. It's like the European leaders who are willing to cut off energy to their own people, to the poor and working people of Europe in order to satisfy NATO. They're not representing any constituents. You've been listening to my discussion with Aaron Mate of Biden's pseudo-secret visit to Kyiv this past week. I'm your host at Gray Zone Radio, Max Blumenthal. Well, while Biden was overseas, two of his top foreign policy advisors, National Security Council Director Jake Sullivan and Assistant Secretary of State Samantha Power, attempted to answer rising concerns by Americans about the escalation of the Ukraine proxy war and its cost. They did so at a CNN-sponsored so-called town hall that was sealed off from any anti-war elements that might have presented a forceful challenge to the narrative Sullivan and Power presented. Alongside Aaron Mate, I discussed the history of these curious CNN town halls, and we presented another exchange between a top Biden ally and an actual anti-war protester. Check it out. Matt Gaetz has introduced a Ukraine Fatigue Act, and the country is becoming fatigued about the war. Support for the Ukraine proxy war, for sending all this money to Ukrainian warlords. The numbers are going down among Democrats. A new poll in Italy by a mainstream Italian paper, maybe I'll put up the poll later, shows that a vast majority of Italians would like to end the war immediately and require Ukraine to cede territory to Russia that it has lost in order to save lives and end the war. Italians are suffering economically far worse than Americans are. I was there in November, in early November, and the public heat was being delayed for several weeks because of energy shortages. So those numbers make sense. So Samantha Power has gone to Fareed Zakaria, a real hard-hitting interviewer who's definitely going to ask some extremely critical questions, to have a town hall. I think it was alongside Jake Sullivan, in order to explain the importance of the war to Americans. And it wasn't exactly like they were allowing the town into this hall, because if that had happened, the results would have been different. Let's hear from Samantha Power, who is basically the queen of humanitarian R2P liberal interventionism.
What is at stake in Ukraine are values and interests so core to the United States.
Values. They always talk about values.
Just wanting your freedom and your independence. I mean, this country is predicated on exactly those two values. Imagine the counterfactual, where we walk away or we didn't show up in the first place. And what that would mean when...
If we didn't show up in the first place, this never would have happened. She's just... everything she's saying is so suffused with deception.
And a dictator who has shut down civil society, shut down independent media, shut down dissenting voices in his own country.
Is she talking about Zelensky? Because there's no independent media in Ukraine.
Then
is she talking about imprisoning Julian Assange?
And with impunity, take over that country. I mean, what would that mean?
No one's trying to take over Ukraine.
For our allies in Europe, what would that mean for our own security over time? So I think, you know, Americans understand bullies and the importance of standing up to bullies. At the same time, again, we're very alert to the risks, given that Russia is a nuclear armed power, as you rightly say. But that is, again, how we are in the position that we are in now, building a coalition of countries, coming together, making sure that this isn't just the United States and Russia, that this, in fact, is Ukrainians on the front lines, Ukrainians doing the fighting, and a coalition of 50 countries rallying behind them, and including actually today, more than 140 countries at the UN signaling, still a year into the war, their support for Ukraine's self-defense.
There's a lot to chew on there. I'm surprised how inarticulate she is, considering her background in media and how she's been propped up as such a genius. And I wonder, is she as daft as she seems, or is she selling the American public on a bunch of lies? Because virtually everything she said was false or contained some element of misinformation. I mean,
she's a seasoned scam artist. She's been pushing lies to justify U.S. aggression in country after country, in Syria, in Libya. And she's applying that to here. And she has this kind of, her and Maddow have a similar shtick where they'll pretend to be sort of like, they have this kind of earnest shtick. Well, they pretend to just be like, they don't understand why our enemies can't possibly understand how generous we are and how well-intentioned we are. And imagine if we weren't there doing all these wonderful things, what a terrible world it is. So she poses as a humanitarian to spread aggression and death. I mean, that's her job. And she's one of the most disingenuous people, I think, in political life today. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, first of all, you're doing a town hall with Fareed Zakaria. Zakaria, it demonstrates how the colonial subject can propel his ambitions within an imperial society, and that is to be the ultimate stooge of those in power. He never, ever, he goes to Davos and will never ask a tough question. He'll never ask a tough question there in that interview setting. And all of his critical questions are always framed in a way that gives his guest an out. I've never seen any of these people subjected to the kind of tough interviews that, for example, George W. Bush subjected himself to when he went on Meet the Press with Tim Russert. Obviously, he was losing popularity. Americans were dying in the war. But, Biden has never sat down for a tough interview. Vladimir Zelensky, have you ever seen a sit-down interview with him where he actually has to answer tough questions? No. So this is complete theater, and it's actually dramatically different from the last CNN town hall that I remember about a war by a Democratic administration featuring Madeleine Albright, who is kind of a mentor to Samantha Power and the liberal interventionists.
Yeah.
And Albright, by the way, was herself mentored by Zbigniew Brzezinski at Georgetown University. Both are children of Europe who come from anti-communist families, who saw land taken by communists, who came to the United States to try to engineer regime change wars to get revenge on the Soviet Union. So this is an amazing, and I think this should inspire those of you out there who want to get offline and do some activism against this war. This is from a town hall on Iraq. I think it was 1999, after the Iraq Liberation Act was passed, setting the stage by the Clinton administration for the regime change war in Iraq. And it's Sandy Berger and Madeleine Albright. And the town hall actually featured members of the town. It wasn't controlled the way the one with Jake Sullivan and Samantha Power was.
The microphone is off. There we are. What do you have to say about dictators of countries like Indonesia, who we sell weapons to, yet they are slaughtering people in East Timor? What do you have to say about Israel, who is slaughtering Palestinians, who impose martial law? What do you have to say about that? Those are our allies. Why do we sell weapons to these countries? Why do we support them? Why do we bomb Iraq when it commits similar problems?
Yeah, this is a question that goes to the heart of the values that Samantha Power espouses. Everybody knows there's no values there.
There are various examples of things that are not right in this world, and the United States is trying.
Look how big it is in there. It's like a real arena.
That it is necessary to defend the rights of Saddam Hussein, when what we ought to be thinking about is how to make sure that he does not use weapons of mass destruction.
I'd like to.
Shouting, just a moment.
I'm not defending him in the least. What I am saying is that there needs to be consistent application of U.S. foreign policy. We cannot support people who are committing the same violations because they are political allies. That is not acceptable. We cannot violate UN resolutions when it is convenient to us. You're not answering my question, Madam Albright.
So that was what a real town hall would look like if one were allowed. And Aaron, any reaction?
Well, I think they've learned their lesson from the Albright experience, because there hasn't been anything that I can remember like that since. That was an amazing episode. That was broadcast live on CNN. I remember it well. And there, I mean, something like that since hasn't happened. The closest we've gotten to the truth from our U.S. officials is when they accidentally blurted out. Like, remember when Joe Biden was speaking at Harvard College in 2015 or 2014, and he accidentally admitted that there was no moderate rebels in Syria, and that the U.S. allies were supporting an insurgency dominated by, he said, Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
Sponsored by Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Yeah. It's like, the problem is our allies over there.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, he gets the briefings and he doesn't know that you're not supposed to actually tell the public the truth. So he went on some international apology tour, and he had to call Erdogan. Sorry. Please keep the ISIS guys going over the border.
Yeah.
John Kerry's watching them.
Yeah. And of course, and there's no journalist to ask these people any of these questions, because they don't get, no one gets challenged. I mean, look, again, even the progressives in Congress, when they go on their friendly media outlets, nobody questions. The only person I've seen question a progressive member of Congress aggressively when it comes to the Ukraine proxy war was Breonna Joy Gray when she interviewed Ro Khanna. I can't think of any other examples.
Well,
unless you did, of course, in the street. But I mean, when they go on shows, it doesn't happen anymore.
Well, Anna Kasparian gave a hardball interview to Madeleine Albright at the Munich Security Conference.
Yeah, right. I think she actually tried to argue, like whenever that whole thing was happening where they called me a Russian agent and blah, blah, blah. I think she tried to argue that she did actually give Madeleine Albright an adversarial interview, which is so funny. But anyway, who cares?
Yeah, it's an honor to meet you and such a pleasure. And wow, yeah. Let's pose for pictures with this great feminist icon who blew up women in Serbia and Iraq.
Yeah.
Well, there actually was a confrontation recently by Jose Vega, who's a political activist in the Bronx or New York, and Hakeem Jeffries, who's the new Democratic minority leader. And I thought this was significant. This is what journalists should be doing. This is what anti-war activists should be doing.
Yep.
And let's take a look at that.
The UN Security Council had a meeting yesterday, and Ray McGovern spoke to it. He is a former member of the CIA, and he testified in support of Seymour Hersh's article on the United States bombing Nord Stream.
And this is a town hall.
If it is proven that the United States bombed the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, as has been asserted by Seymour Hersh and his article, will you call for the United States to acknowledge and admit that that was an act of war against Germany and Russia? And I'm asking this because this may be the only way to prevent the rest of us from being killed in a thermonuclear war. And I don't want to be fried. Don't you think the media should be reporting on whether or not this is true? And don't you think you should be inquiring into whether or not this is true?
Well, thank you for the question. One, I've got no information to suggest that the United States was involved in bombing the North.
Of course you don't.
Because he would have, you would have been, you weren't briefed on it.
Sir, you got your chance to ask a question.
You gave me an opportunity to respond.
You weren't given information because he explicitly says you weren't briefed on it. Shouldn't it require?
So here's what I'll say about, I think, President Biden's leadership generally as it relates to the Ukraine and Russia.
We committed an act of war. What are you doing to respond to that? We have to hold Biden accountable. Listen, you're from Brooklyn, right? You know when to call bullshit when you see it. So do I. This is bullshit right now. And I see what's happening right now.
That does not silence me. So you can hear me right now. I want you to say something about the bombing, because we're all going to die from a nuclear war right now unless you stop it and you at least put an inquiry into whether or not it's true. This war in Ukraine is going to leave us all dead. So what are you going to do? Because you need to inquire. I'm a New Yorker too.
Here's what I'll say.
Say it.
We're going to continue to stand with the Ukrainian people.
That's fucking bullshit. Do not do that. You will end us all dead.
In this war against
Vladimir Putin. We need peace. We need talks. Why are you sabotaging talks? Do not put your hands on me. We need peace talks. I am not going to take this.
It's a battle.
Well, that's how you do it. I mean, I think that's how you have to do it at this point. To get your point across, especially if you feel like there's any urgency here as the conflict escalates. I see a lot of people kind of dismissing the idea that this could turn nuclear. But in any case, that was Hakeem Jeffries' response, and it was complete boilerplate. I mean, Hakeem Jeffries is a company man. We've talked about him before. He's a pet project of the Israel lobby and of Wall Street. That's all for this week's edition of Gray Zone Radio. I've been your host, Max Blumenthal. If you want to see more of our investigative reporting and sign up for our newsletter, visit thegrayzone.com. That's GRAYzone.com. This show was produced by Christopher Weaver.
If you're listening to us right now, KPFK may be one of your favorite things. You should know that KPFK is one of the stations in the Pacifica Radio Network. The concept of community radio in the United States was established when the Pacifica Foundation started KPFA in Berkeley in 1949. A decade later, KPFK came on the airwaves and ever since has strived to fulfill the Pacifica mission. To contribute to a lasting understanding between nations and individuals of all races, creeds, and colors. To promote creative activities that serve the cultural welfare of our community and stimulate grassroots radio content. And to be self-sustaining. And this is where you're able to play a crucial role. We're listener-sponsored radio. So you fund our operations, and in doing so, realize Pacifica's noble mission. Right now, you can call 818-985-5735 and pledge support to one of your favorite things. KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
My name is Leon. I've come up listening to KPFK. It's wonderful. I really got into it with Roy's show, Midnight to Six, Roy of Hollywood. Learned so much. It's an education. Just wonderful. It's one of the dangers of KPFK. When you turn it on, if you're into it, there's nothing else going to go on. But, yeah, this is just a great place. Loads and loads of stuff. And no matter what you want, it's here. And I wouldn't be myself without it. I mean, I've got KPFK in my blood.
KPFK, listener supported, 99% approved.
If your automobile, truck, boat, motorcycle, RV, or aircraft is no longer reliable, it can still go a long way towards supporting the programs you rely on as a donation. To donate it to KPFK, call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
Hi, everyone. I know you've heard our fundraisers and likely thought, yeah, I should likely give something back to KPFK. Well, now's the time to do it. We all understand the value of separating luxuries from necessities and deciding what's truly essential. KPFK is one of those essentials. We provide in-depth, cutting-edge, intelligent coverage, and it starts with our amazing staff and volunteer programmers and with your financial support. Contributions from our listeners add up to the largest share of funding that pays the bills here at KPFK. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, encouraging you to become a KPFK Sustainers Circle member now. A sustaining contribution of just $20 or more a month is one of the most popular levels for our donors, and it takes just minutes to contribute. Just go to kpfk.org/support, then click Sustainer Circle, or call 818-985-2711. Thank you so much for your donation to KPFK, radio powered by the people.
On Saturday mornings, make sure your dial is set at 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles for the Earl Ofari Hutchinson Show. It's an hour filled with news, information, and importantly, your phone calls. So don't miss it every Saturday, 9 a.m., right here on KPFK 90.7 FM and streaming around the globe on kpfk.org.
The grace to shower.